more of a free form. I do have four subjects that I do want to get through in our extended time. I do want to cover surety, which is one of the things that Ray wanted to talk about but was not able to get to. Investing, which was another one that he had hot on his subject or high on his list that he wanted to cover, and yet he didn't give me any notes for, so I had to come up with the stuff on my own. Taxes, which I want to talk about because who doesn't like talking about taxes? And then habits, because really a lot of things that we're going to come down to today and throughout this course really come down to habits. So surety. What is surety? Co-signing is surety?
Any
collateral. Surety is the act of putting something down for somebody else, guarantor, things of that nature, so it could be with a loan. Ray likes to bring it up in the context of partnership, saying that, you know, you sign up with a partnership with somebody else, your name's on the line as well. We know that because California's community property state. Thank you. I knew it started with a C. So if Betsy goes out and decides that we need a new cell phone plan and she signs up, then man, that's on me too. And that's okay because she's great. And she researched it, so. And afterwards, if anybody wants to see her new cool phone, she'll show it to you. I don't want to say that Christmas kind of went awry in our household, but we had decided on Christmas presents, and then a couple days later, Betsy ends up with a new phone. And I'm thinking to myself, birthdays and anniversaries aren't like for another 8 months. It's going to be hard to stretch that. Happy Valentine's Day, honey. I think that you guys do have the surety notes from Ray's handout, but I wanted to read Proverbs 6, 1 through 5, since that's the one that he kept coming back to. My son, if you have become surety for your neighbor, have given a pledge for a stranger, if you have been snared by the words of your mouth, have been caught with the words of your mouth, do this then, my son, and deliver yourself. Since you have come into the hand of your neighbor, go humbly yourself and importune your neighbor. I don't even know what that means. Ask your neighbor. Give no sleep to your eyes, nor slumber to your eyelids. Deliver yourself like a gazelle from the hunter's hand and like a bird from the hand of the fowler. In essence, pointing to this scripture, Ray is saying that if you've gotten yourself into one of these situations, go and get out of it as quickly as possible. Do whatever is necessary to get out of those situations. And the example that he was giving was, again, going back to the partnership. If you get into a general partnership with somebody else, in the state of California, and I think in pretty much most of the states, that person can sign a contract, and it's for the partnership. And if you don't have a limited liability situation, well, then that can have recourse to you and to the things that you own. If somebody engages that organization, that partnership, into a contract, then you have signed the line. It's as if you've signed on the dotted line yourself. Now, the beauty of that is that people know that that's a problem, and that's why we have limited liability situations like limited liability corporations, which can be set up as a partnership where, much like when you invest in the stock market, if you put your money on those shares, the total amount that you can lose is the amount that you invested in those shares. The equity that you put in is what you are liable to lose by investing in stock. If you get into a limited liability partnership or limited liability corporation, very similarly, it can be structured in such a way as you're putting money on the line, and that's all you're committing to it. It's a separate entity, and as long as you follow the rules which dictate those things, that entity can go under, and in most situations, there's no recourse to you. Now, that brings us up to the question of partnerships. What's the benefit of a partnership? Well, you know, things like marriage, it's nice because hopefully you have people that are coming together and bringing different elements and different strengths to the union, and you can rely on one another to help and to build a firmer foundation for yourself and for your family. And in the United States, you know, marriage is pretty much 100% successful for everybody. And so why wouldn't you want to go out with your best friend and say, hey, let's bind ourselves into a partnership? Well, partnerships fail. They fail all the time because guess what? We're pretty much looking out for our own best interest a lot of the time. And it's nice to be in a Christian marriage, as Dr. Van Drunen was saying towards the end of his message today. We don't go out and marry non-Christians because they've got a different worldview than we do. We've got different perspectives. If you go into marriage, we have very clear, in Christian marriage, we have a pretty clear definition of different roles that we're supposed to take on. And a lot of that has to do with sacrifice and serving one another in love. In business relationships, we can enter a partnership with another Christian, and yet a lot of times you still start thinking to yourself, well, what's good for me and what's good for that other person? So I would simply say, as far as even limited liability corporations are concerned, you might not have the same extent of the surety that you would have in a common general partnership, but a lot of times it's a difficult situation to be in because of people's best interests. I was in a partnership, or Betsy and I were, again, going back to the communal property stuff, Betsy and I were in a partnership with one of our groomsmen who happens to be a great Christian man, like very much. And, you know, there were still struggles, and it was a strain on our relationship as friends and brothers in Christ because it just adds a different level of stress. Is there anything that anybody else wants to add to the surety conversation or why they think partnerships are great? Good. Glad everybody's convinced. So don't do it. Just say no. One of the things that Ray brought up very early on is that, as far as a biblical principle is concerned, is that the way that you grow wealth, according to him, biblically, is slow and steady over time. That the idea that you're going to rush out and get rich quick is generally, although not universally, is a situation where you're exchanging. It's kind of like the lottery principle. You're just hoping things will work out. In my business, since I work with a number of corporations and partnerships that are at different various stages of growth on their success journeys, one of the things that I frequently find is in partnerships, when people come together, be it two or more people, there's usually one person in the group that's really thinking to themselves, this other person's going to really make this work for me. Like maybe I'm putting money into the deal, but this other person's really just a whiz-bang person, and I'm really lucky to be able to hitch my wagon to this shooting star type idea. And it's always a little bit awkward for me to be in those situations as a financial advisor in certain ways, because you kind of get the impression that at least one of the people, if not both of them in a partnership, are thinking to themselves, I'm going to get rich off this other person. Whereas what you find with a lot of the corporations that I work with is, even if there's multiple shareholders, they usually go into it and they're saying, you know what, it really comes down to me. I've got this idea that I'm going to be going out, risking my equity, my capital, and if I don't perform, then it's a lost cause. So I warn people, and I would just throw that out as a statement about different ideas. If you get into the situation where either you're thinking like this other person is really going to knock it out of the park and be our home run hitter, and I just get to sit in the stands and clap, or if you get the feeling that somebody else is doing that with you, you know, I start to get concerned that it's one of those get rich. Yes, sir.
Can you expand a little bit on that? Let's say you you come across somebody that has what you consider a whiz-bang idea,
yeah,
but maybe they lack the capital to get going, and you want to back them or whatever. Are you saying it would be better to you put up the money, start a company with you as the CEO, and then hire them as an employee rather than go into a joint venture kind of thing?
I'd say that there's a number of different ways to structure it, but I would say that what I found, because the partnership example usually is somebody's contributing money and the other person's contributing either sweat equity or the idea that's going to get it off the ground. And the person that's trying to get it off the ground might be technically savvy, but might not know the great deal about business one way or the other, might not come from the same, be cut from the same cloth or have share the same worldview as the other person. And so the person that's contributing the money says, here it is, and it's not a clearly defined relationship necessarily. The reason they set it up as a partnership is because it's easier to structure how the money's going to come out, whereas it's more rigid in the corporate structure. But I would say anything where you can come in, you can say, you know what, this is clearly the relationship that we're going to have. These are the benchmarks that we're going to establish. And you have that planning done at the front end rather than saying, hey, we're just going to go in and we're going to throw our lots together and hope that it works out because you're really smart and I'm filthy rich. But if you're filthy rich, just sit on your money. Which brings us to investing. I went to... Does anybody still get the newspaper, or does everybody read the news online? Every year, in the sports section, which is the only section of the newspaper I used to read, especially when it was at the office in the break room, I would see this advertising for a seminar series called Get Motivated. Has anybody seen those? They have pictures of like Rudy Giuliani, Schottenheimer, back when he was the coach of the Chargers, Steve Forbes. I mean, it was a Zig Ziglar, who's list of like famous people. And it would be a full page ad in the sports section. You could go to this seminar for like $5. And I'm thinking to myself, this has got to be a trick. Like they're going to send you and there's going to be like a 32-inch TV monitor and 6,000 people like straining their necks trying to see it and they're beaming it in from New York City or something like that. But no, actually these guys all show up different cities around the state or the country for these one-day seminars. And it's supposed to be to get you pumped up. Well, turns out that I went with Patrick Cray and a couple other people, and it did cost me $5. It was pretty awesome. We went down to the sports arena, and it was just jam-packed, and Zig Ziglar opened, and I'm like, man, Zig Ziglar, this guy is, as far as speaking goes, I mean, a name in and of himself. He's a brand unto himself. You know, this is amazing. And he got up there, and then Steve Forbes was up there, and I was like, man, if he would have been this entertaining when he was running for president, I mean, maybe he would have had a shot. So they keep going, and what it turned out to be was it's a Christian organization, and the guy that runs it gets up before lunch and shares like a 4 spiritual laws gospel presentation and tries to get people to sign up. And so it was a little bit of a bait and switch, which was something unto itself. But it was interesting, and I made it through half the day before I decided that I had other things that I needed to do. But I did get to see Zig Ziglar, which was pretty exciting. The thing that was most interesting about Get Motivated, Inc. to me was Steve Forbes gets up there and he starts talking about what we've been talking about in Sunday school, that, you know what, we probably need to have budgets in place and we need to be wiser with our money, both individually and as a nation. And there's a lot of things that we're doing that's getting ourselves in trouble. And it comes down to his recommendation is that you have a little bit of your money withheld from your paycheck every week or every 2 weeks, whenever you get paid, and you put that money into index funds. You guys know what index funds are? They track like the Dow Jones or the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ, but very safe, kind of conservative mutual funds or index funds with no loads and no fees. So it's just on autopilot. That money's getting dumped in. Steve Forbes. Can't lose. Maybe.
Yeah, well, usually. Because I got an annuity that's indexed, and it can go down to a certain point, and if it goes below that, they lose. They guarantee that.
Okay. So it's conservative. What he was suggesting was somewhat conservative. I mean, it's not as conservative as a bond, but certainly it would be conservative under most people's definition. Next guy gets up there. He has the number one investing book for 2006 on Amazon.com. It's called The Number One Rule. And this guy's up there. He's dynamic and he's moving around. It looks like he's been at Starbucks all morning. And we're just getting pumped up at the salespeople, because there are a lot of salespeople there. The salespeople beside me, I mean, they're leaning forward on their seats, just eating it up. And he's got this PowerPoint presentation that's showing you these stock slides. And you guys know the charts where the lines are going up and up and up. And I'm feeling Richard just sitting there. And he wants you to go out and spend $1,500 on a three-day seminar where he's going to teach you his investing system that he learned from a guy that learned from another guy that learned it from Warren Buffett. And we all know Warren Buffett. So the deal was that you have these indicators that you can see on these charts that you can pay him to subscribe for, and you jump in and out of stocks about every 30 days or so. And he said, you know, going back in time, hindsight 2020, if you use his system, you'll have like a 60,000 percentage return on your investment in the first 4 days. And I was like, man, that sounds awesome. But Ray said that if it's get rich quick, it's probably too good to be true. And I listen to everything that Ray says, unless I don't like it, and then I ignore it. So this guy, I mean, Steve Forrest had just gotten up there and said, invest in index funds. This next guy gets up and says, forget that. You know, you need to do this thing and sign up for this seminar. The next guy that gets up there is the head of Get Motivated, Inc., and he's the one that made this gospel presentation. But before he did, he started talking about investing in taxes and how if you invest money and you make it and you take it out of that investment, well, then you get a capital gains tax. And then you put it back into something else, but you only have like maybe 80% of it because the government had taken their share. And you make money, and then you pull it out, and you get taxed. And so he said, if you keep doing that, basically, you're not going to grow your investment as quickly as if you can get it into something, something magical, where the government doesn't take any money out of it. And you're like, wow, what could that be? And he was basically encouraging us to go out and buy real estate and do this thing called the 1031 exchange, where you can buy a property, let it appreciate, flip it into another property, but the government lets you defer the taxes on it as long as you follow their very specific rules. And so I'm thinking to myself, wow, here's Steve Forbes. He's telling me, use index funds and just have it taken out, put it on autopilot. Here's this next guy saying, go out and like spend money on his three-day seminar and pay for his subscription online service. And here's a third guy saying, forget the stock market altogether. Go out and buy real estate and keep flipping it. And I was thinking to myself, it's no wonder that people don't invest money, because it's so darn confusing. Started reading a couple Christian books on investment. I've mentioned this book a couple times already. Money Came by the House the other day, written by a Christian CPA in New Orleans. And started reading his chapter, very interested in what he had to write on investing. And what he wrote on investing was, if you don't understand it, you shouldn't be investing in it. And there's no magic to investing, so you ought to manage your own funds. He said, okay, that sounds like a lot more work than I'm willing to do. And I'm a CPA, so is this guy. And nowhere in his book does he write, you shouldn't pay taxes unless you understand them, and you shouldn't hire somebody else to do it. So why is it that you should hire a CPA to do your taxes, which you all should, especially a Christian CPA that goes to your church? Not really. But you shouldn't hire somebody to help you with your investment portfolio. So it doesn't seem to make that much sense to me. What I came away with, and this would be my recommendation, is there's probably a lot of things that you can invest your money in. There are some people out here, you know, Ray could tear down a building and rebuild it in one day by himself, I'm fairly convinced. I mean, carpentry, anything construction-wise, he's got, what are you now, 65? He's got 40 years of experience plus, probably, in that industry, if it was his desire to spend his time and his energy and his money going out and finding homes that he could fix up and make them just pristine and brand new so that he could, quote unquote, flip those properties, that might be a great investment for him. For me, A, I don't have the expertise. B, I don't have the desire. And C, I'm really not all that good with those things. That would be a horrible investment for me. You know, if I was managing something like that, I would be sending all my money to, you know, John Rigo to go fix the air conditioning unit, or begging Ray to help me on the weekends, and he, you know, would get sick of that. So that would not be a good investment for me. But if there was something that you were really into and that you really knew about and were intimately knowledgeable about, that might be a great place for you to invest money. If, on the other hand, you're like me with very little skills, not that much, you know, world experience, just kind of cruising along, other than the fact I'm a great CPA, you might want to get somebody else to help you with investing. And that's what I do. You know, I turn it over to somebody that knows stuff about it. But you know what? We still have the responsibility of being stewards with our money. And so our responsibility with that is come down to, what does this other person know? If we're going to hand our money over to this person, do they understand the things that we don't understand? Can they actually be good stewards with our money that we're entrusting them with? One of the things that we've brought up repeatedly in this seminar, or in the Sunday school class, I'm sorry, is the parable of the talents. And we've looked at it from the perspective of the servants. As they get their talents, what have they done with them? But let's flip it around and look at it from the perspective of the master. The master has taken these talents, the 10, the 5, and the 1, and he's given them to his servants. And then he's come back to see what they've done with it. Similarly, if we choose to have somebody invest our funds for us, we're saying, these are the funds that we've been entrusted with, and we're going to now entrust them with you. And what did the master do? The master had standards. And that's what we need to establish for our money, or for the money that we've been entrusted with. Regardless of whether or not we're going out and investing in ourselves in something that we have great knowledge of, or if we're entrusting it to somebody else to invest on our behalf, we have to have standards to which we're holding that person or ourselves accountable to. There's lots of people that will go out and invest in penny stocks because it seems like it's, you know, fun and it's exciting. And you go out and, man, it doubled in price because it went up by 4 cents. I mean, that's awesome. But over the long term, is that really giving us the rate of return which we expect? And I think that regardless of whether or not you're doing it yourself or whether or not you're having somebody else invest for you, you need to have those established. And your responsibility as a steward is to make sure that that money is actually growing and doing the things that it should be doing. Any thoughts, feelings? Okay, good. Glad we're all together.
There's a book, like, it's called, it's an old book, so they're probably newer ones, like what you were sharing. One called How to Use What You Already Know to Make Money in the Stock Market. And that was an example of, I think, some of the things you said. It's like, who are the stakeholders is a good question. So not just that it's a fund, like an index fund, there's going to be some stated rules, but if you've got like a manager that's taking care of things and you look to all those things, sometimes they're working for some big firm and they don't want to buy some podunk stock because, well, that, who ever heard of this company? But if you know it yourself, you might, this is kind of dated, but use examples of like the man wanted to buy Bethlehem Steel because everybody was buying Bethlehem Steel, but it was too late. It had already had its run. And it's sort of like big companies that used to say, thou shalt IBM, I mean, before the last computing revolution. And if you bought something else, they just say, oh, it's okay, because IBM had a bad day that day. So they think they're being conservative, but they're really not. They're just shepherd, sheep mentality, following some big leader. So that's, I think, I really just like to emphasize that. You really have to use what you know and what you can understand and build that understanding. And think about how much you can risk, really, too, if you're responsible for all that.
Thanks, Brian. One of the things that flows from investing the taxes is the tax deferred investments that we have. I said that the person that started Get Motivated Inc., I mean, he talked about ways that you could have your money grow tax deferred. The first Sunday that I spoke, I had a chart that was distributed electronically that kind of showed how money can grow tax deferred and the advantages with that. But in order to really appreciate tax deferred investments, we all need to understand a little bit about taxes. Okay, so go ahead, get comfortable, break out your blankets, because we're about to fall asleep. I'm kidding. This is exciting. You guys are all going to love this, because as far as my clients are concerned, I'm not polled this congregation necessarily, but my clients, they never seem all that excited about paying taxes. So if we can learn something or take away that there's a possible way that we can have a lower tax liability, you know, that's exciting. Taxes are pretty straightforward. I think of this kind of as like the 80-20 rule. Like for 80% of the people, income tax is pretty straightforward. And then you've got the 20% that it's like the 100-page tax return that I filed for one of my individual clients, and you're like, I didn't know that there were 100 forms, much less 100 pages that we put in this tax return. One of the people that works with Redfern & Company, she's actually at a company that got, a publicly traded company that got bought out by another one. And she's been employed there 40 hours a week since April 15th, and she's probably going to be there until the middle of this coming summer, just filling out the forms necessary for the government to close down that corporation. The final tax returns for the different states where they had operations, the federal returns, the SEC required forms. There are so many forms and so many taxes that we could go into. It's silly, but the great thing is that it doesn't affect most of us. Basic rules on taxes, as far as I understand them, is income. That's where we always start. I do a seminar at Small Business Development Center, and I say, when you fill out your tax return, if you don't get any other numbers right, make sure that you get your income right. Because guess what? Other people are required to send in forms about the money that they paid you to the federal government. So it's pretty straightforward in this day of computers for the government just to do automatic check on everybody's tax return to say, this is what Paul said he made, and this is what all the companies that send in 1099s or W-3s or whatever it may be on his behalf, this is how much they say they paid him. So everybody else is going to do a good job of reporting what money you've made, so this is probably a good place to start to get it right. So, you know, common things for income are going to be your W-2. If you're a salary or wage earner, the people are going to report how much they paid you. Your 1099s that you're going to get from investments, your dividends, your interest, things like that. And this is usually a pretty good, pretty easy number because all these forms are supposed to come in between January 1st and January 31st. So you guys have all gotten Christmas cards for the last month, which was kind of fun. This next month, you get to get all these tax forms. So, you know, who's to say which is better? The second section, which people kind of overlook, is adjustments to income. Adjustments to incomes aren't really deductions. Adjustments to incomes are kind of like the government saying, well, you told us you made this money, but if you've got the right adjustments, we're just going to pretend like you didn't. Now, the number one adjustments that most people are familiar with, anybody want to take a shot? IRAs. See, and you were shaking your head, giving me like, no, I don't want to hear about taxes, and you had the IRA. See? The IRA, or the 401k, or the 403b if you work for a not-for-profit. These are retirement funds that you put your money into this tax year, and the government says, you know what, we're going to pretend like you really didn't earn that money. This year, we're going to let you put it into an investment fund, and we're going to let you earn returns on that. And then when you retire, hopefully, in the government eyes, at a much higher tax bracket, then we'll tax it. So the IRA, or the 401k, are adjustments to income. These are what we call above the line in the tax world. The other great one that's fairly new that we could all probably take advantage of, something called an HSA, or Section 125 plan. They're two separate things, but accomplish the same end almost. These are things where we can set up withholdings for specific health purposes. So if we have or health payments that we need to pay, we can put it into an HSA or Section 125 account and take that money out for those specific reasons. It has to be like qualified purpose, like teeth whitening.
There's a maybe a fork in the road on that. There's a, you have to have a certain type of a plan to get an HSA or an MSA. And if you look at those, we just went through all this at my company. So to shorten an hour of discussions on it to a minute, you've got basically, if you're young and healthy and you have high prospects for health, it works out really well. You can put up to $5,000 into that account, and then it's a $5,000 deductible. But if you don't have the health problem, that money is all, you can use it later in life for anything else after a certain period. You aren't in that situation, you might be better off with the other plans, the FSA, the flexible spending account, but you have to be careful with that to plan your expenses for the whole year. So if you can, if you know you're going to have $2,000 worth of prescription drugs, you can put that in, and then that's pre-tax. So there's that. And there's actually a new one for people who commute. There's a travel version of that. So if you take the train and you know you're going to spend $140 every month, you can have money taken out, put into that plan, and then withdraw it and use it on fare. So there's those kinds of plans.
So in summary, if you didn't have one of these in 2007, see if you can get one in 2008, because there's a lot of things that actually fall under the umbrella. I mean, Section 125 is the plan that's probably the most flexible, but you have to spend the money that you put in the same year, whereas an HSA, you can continue to have it grow like a health IRA over time. And then if you don't use it by the time you retire for medical purposes, you can take it out just as like a regular retirement account. So they're pretty good. They will save you money, and we'll find out why in just one second. If you take your income and subtract your adjustments, you get this thing called adjusted gross income, or your AGI, which is a significant number nowadays, especially with AMT, because a lot of your phase-outs on the normal tax plan and some of the calculations on the AMT come off your adjusted gross income. So anything that you can get up here that brings you your adjusted gross income down will help you with phase-outs depending on where your income range is. Okay, now we get to what are called deductions. And I heard somebody earlier say that one of the biggest deductions is your home mortgage, if you've got a home mortgage. But there's a number of other things, like charitable giving, that falls into the deductions category. Now, they're significant because they will bring down your total before we actually calculate the tax on your income. Last week, we talked about looking at your tax return when you got home to calculate how much tax, what percentage of tax you actually paid on your gross income. Everybody went home and did that, right? Okay. No. That's fine. Doesn't hurt my feelings. It's your money. One of the deductions that you can take is your health costs. You can deduct some of your health costs. But I was just pushing the HSA in the Section 125. Why? I mean, if it's deductible on the one side or an adjustment on the other, what does it matter? They limit how much you can deduct of your health costs to anything over 7.5% of your adjusted gross income, which is the number that we just talked about. So there's something that you can do to get 100% of it basically tax-free by setting up the Section 125 or the HSA or whatever it may be versus having it be limited to anything over 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. I mean, for simplicity's sake, if your adjusted gross income is $100,000, that means that you're not going to get any tax savings on the first $7,500 that, you know, you've spent on those things. That doesn't seem fair. D.
Is there a minimum amount for a deduction on health costs? So in other words, do you have to have spent, say, $2,500 on health situations in order to claim it as a deduction?
Yes. You have to spend at least it has to be over 7.5% of your district gross. Yeah.
What, you can deduct only the amount over 7.5?
Yes. So, you know, if you're in a situation where maybe you've got seven kids, like, you top out over that pretty quickly, right? One or two injuries, boom. If you're not in that situation, it's kind of hard, which is what I've always found, because you know what? I spend money on things like that I don't want to spend money on, like, hey, guess what? You cracked a molar. Got to fix it. Dentists aren't cheap, but it's legitimate health costs. If I would have had the HSA set up, I could have funneled it through there. But now I'm going to get phased out because of the adjusted gross income limit. Well, once you get your deductions, you can take a standard deduction or you can take this. You also have exemptions that which you can take. And there's a lot of things that will get you to your final taxable income. If you would have looked at your tax return yesterday, last week as an action item, I think that what you would have found, in most cases, the total amount of income tax that's paid off that top income number is relatively low compared to the percentages that we hear about when politicians start speaking. If you are like me and you went to the IRS website and printed out the tax table for 2007 tax returns as soon as it came out 3 months ago, pretty cool stuff. You know, they're going to tell you that the top income tax limit is 35%. So if you make over a certain amount, you're going to hit that 35% bracket. But if your taxable income, so not your income, but your income after adjustments, deductions, and exemptions is below $63,700 and you're filing a joint return with your spouse, the most that you're going to pay in taxes is 15% to the federal government. $63,700. And that's, I mean, it's no flat tax, don't get me wrong. But if we had a flat tax, what would I do for money? 15% seems pretty low compared to a lot of the numbers that I hear bantied about. When I generally give, like, the two-hour seminar that I give on a monthly basis for the Small Business Development Center, when we ask people, what do you think the average amount of taxes that you pay for income tax are, people generally overestimate it. So I would just throw that out there as a point of hope for all you people that are dreading your taxes. Taxes can be fun. How many people get money back on a regular basis after they file their tax returns? Okay, so you know, that means that you can fill out your tax return starting like the day after tomorrow, and you get that money back sooner rather than later. That would be my recommendation. But people don't do that because they're like, that's not fun. Right.
The companies wait until January 31st to send you the stuff. I mean, it's their, you know, like 1099s and that show up the last week in January.
Yeah. I mean, that's because your companies are probably in the same predicament as most individuals. They're not that excited about filling out government forms either. But, you know, a lot of that stuff's on the final pay stub or on your account information or on your last mortgage payment stub. Hey, I'm not saying to go home and figure it out for yourself when they're going to do it for you. But I don't know. If you don't have anything else going on Friday night, bag of popcorn, I don't know. It sounds like a good time. So let me bring up one other thing. Oh, crap. We always run out of time. It's not fair. It's not fair. We get excited, get fun stuff like taxes, and then where's the time go? I don't know. Ray said that business owners get gypped. That, you know, I think he even said don't go into business for yourself because you'll pay a ton more in taxes, which is weird because he's been his own business owner for like 20 years. So maybe he's just trying to trick you guys and not doing it because he likes it so much. He's concerned if other people do it, then it'll get changed. I've only been in business for myself for like 11 months, but Betsy's been in business for herself ever since we had Jack because she freelance writes for Iron Man Live. So we got to fill out that extra form, that Schedule C on our tax returns for a couple years now, which is, you know, a lot of fun. But what he was bringing up was that you have to pay, if you're in business for yourself and you make money, then you have to pay what's called self-employment tax, which is about 15%, even though in reality, after everything's said and done, it's really closer to 13%. Ray won't tell you that, but I will. It's less than 15.3, it's like 13. And the more you pay in taxes, then the lower that percentage gets. So, if you guys want to do some algebra with me later, I'm available. You, as an, if you're an employee, you pay 7.65% and a little bit more anyways. So, I mean, we're talking about, at best, a 7.65% spread on the amount of money that's coming in from wages. But your businesses calculate in how much your total cost of employment is. You know, they don't look at it like, oh, well, this is the person's salary and all things are said and done. No, they look at your benefits. They look at the payroll taxes. They look at everything that they've got to spend in order to have an employee. And so, I mean, they're taking it out of what they could pay you anyways, is my opinion. And there are different things that you can do on your Schedule C, like deduct half your health insurance as an above-the-line deduction. You know, there are other things that the government gives you as a small business owner as breaks, because much like the mortgage interest deduction, the government says, hey, it's great if people own houses, they're better parts of the community. The government knows that small businesses create the majority of jobs in this country, and so they want to incentivize people to go out on their own. If you've got the technical skills and the ability, go out on your own. Create jobs for other people. That would be great. That's a win-win for you, a win-win for the government, and probably a win-win for your employees. So I would say that there's a number of ways to make the small business owner's tax burden look a lot rosier just because of the incentives that the government gives out. But Ray's negative. We covered that last week. That was point number four. Ray is negative. I will close on this. I will not go over habits because you guys are all going to go home and make your New Year's resolutions, and we can cover habits a little bit later in the next couple weeks. But I will say this. When we talk about budgeting, we're really talking about planning and we're talking about good habits. If you apply those good habits and that planning to your tax return, you can realize permanent tax savings. Just like the HSA example. If you had set up an HSA, if Paul Redfern would have set up his HSA correctly at the beginning of this year, I would have a permanent tax savings, money that I would never have to pay to the government on money that I'd spent either at the dentist or Jack spent at his child wellness checkups that he keeps telling us he has to go to, or, you know, Betsy's doctor's visit, whatever. If we would have set up the HSA correctly, then we could have had realized a permanent tax savings. The government gave us the option to do it. I didn't do it. I did it wrong. I set it up. I messed it up. So, I apologize. I'm embarrassed. But if I would have done it right, it wouldn't have been huge. Okay, don't get me wrong. I'm not a complete guy. It would have been it just would have been a little bit better. There are things that are temporary tax savings, like everybody could go home tomorrow, because you wouldn't do it on Sunday. Tomorrow morning, it's December 31st, you could mail in the second portion of your property taxes. There's two coupons. One of them was due December 10th. The other one's not due until like April. You could pay it now, and then that would be a deduction if you itemize your deductions. But guess what? You'd get less of a deduction next year because you'd taken it this year. So that would be a temporary tax difference, or temporary tax savings. What this comes down to is, if you're budgeting and you know what you're going to pay in taxes, you can try to pick when it would be better to take temporary deductions and how to maximize your permanent deductions. But it comes down to planning, just like budgeting comes down to planning. And if you're just reactive rather than proactive, to steal Dr. Van Drunen's example, then you're missing out on some opportunities that are available. And possibly, one could say, you're not making the best use of the things that are available to you. Questions and comments? Brian.
Yeah, one of the IRAs you didn't mention is a Roth IRA. I think you can put up to $4,000 in if you make under $130,000, or if you're married under $180,000. Is there some rule of thumb for at what point in somebody's life they ought to be using it, and then at some point probably switch over to regular ones?
Yes.
The idea is that you pay the tax first. Like if you're a young wage earner, you're probably earning 50 grand or less. You're not at this highest tax bracket, so you may as well pay the taxes and then deposit the money. And then 40 years later, when you withdraw it, you have zero taxes on it. Whereas otherwise, like you were saying, the other plans, the government taxes your elevated price at whatever the new tax rate is in the future.
Yes. Thank you, Brian. The Roth options are great for people that are in low tax brackets now, because you might as well pay the tax at 15% versus when you retire, you're probably going to be at the higher tax bracket, and so you're going to be taxed on that money with a traditional IRA at the 25% or more. So because of time, didn't necessarily get into that, but for younger people, even Betsy and I this year, with me starting my business and Betsy staying at home with Jack, you know, our tax rate's a little bit lower than it's been traditionally, and Lord willing, lower than it'll be next year. So, you know, there are certain things that we're doing with regards to that, where it's better to pay your taxes on the smaller amount of money and then take either deductions or the different things like the Roth IRA options this year versus doing something like a traditional IRA at higher tax years. Okay, let's pray and we'll go get our kids. Father, we do thank you for your many gifts. We thank you for the opportunity to gather today. And Father, we thank you most of all for your mercy and your grace in our lives. We ask that you'd be with us as we go about our days, and that you'd bless this Sabbath rest. Amen.